Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From Lower Manhattan, the center of the financial world, this is Money Talking from WNYC. Good morning. I'm Jeff Greenfield. I'm joined today by our regular contributors, Joe Nocera of the New York Times and Rana Faruhar of Time Magazine. In a world dominated by Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook, poor old Yahoo has struggled to keep up. Yes, it's got one of the largest audiences on the web, but it can't find a way to make a solid profit. A matter of some personal interest to me as a Yahoo News columnist. But now it thinks it can change all that. Yahoo, like many other struggling companies before it, has reached for a CEO superstar, tapping a Google executive, a celebrity in business circles, Marissa Mayer, to lead the company. Mayer spent her career at Google, headed up search. You know that white screen on a Google search? You can thank Mayer for that. The question we're asking is, can a celebrity CEO who gets a lot of attention turn around a company in decline? Joe Nocera, what's the track record?
Well, the track record is sometimes. The academic research is not promising on this. It mostly says it doesn't work, but we all have examples where it has worked. Steve Jobs is the most famous one, but Charles Schwab, you know, turned around his own company after he had stepped out. Howard Schultz at Starbucks did the same thing. Mickey Drexler, who had a long run at the Gap as one of the great retailers in the country, took over J.Crew and turned that around. On the other hand, if you just throw a celebrity in there because he's a big name, it often doesn't work. Carly Fiorina at HP is a fabulous example of somebody who just flamed out, as did Barb Nardelli, who had been one of the contenders for the CEO job at General Electric, didn't get it, went to Home Depot, and it was a complete, utter disaster.
But Rana, if the track record is so mixed, why do we see companies keep going for big names?
Well, for every celebrity CEO, there are many, many who aren't. After the last decade of corporate scandals, everything from Enron to the financial crisis, I think CEOs know that they're under the microscope, their boards are watching very carefully, the government is watching more carefully in some cases, and I think that they, if they're smart, want to just sort of keep their head down and do the job.
Well, we also spoke to Rakesh Khurana, a professor at Harvard Business School who has studied this issue about when troubled companies hire celebrity CEOs. This is what he said.
What boards are often doing is looking for a savior. They typically don't go through the process of saying, what are our challenges? What are the issues that we're facing? How do we modify and ensure that we have the skill set there? They typically jump to, who could we get?
Rana, is that what Yahoo did?
Well, you might think so, because as you point out, Marissa is a complete rock star, not only in Silicon Valley, but in all of corporate America. But Silicon Valley is a little different. For starters, I think the cult of Steve Jobs still looms very large there. They do tend to go for sort of bigger personalities. And I think Marissa herself is very different. I mean, yes, she's a celebrity CEO in the sense that she's been photographed in Vogue. She's great with the media. She's beautiful. The fact that she's a mother-to-be is big news now. But first, she's a user experience fanatic. She's very, very focused on the end product. And that's what Yahoo, which has kind of branded itself as a media company unsuccessfully, needs right now. They need to create some real products, some real innovation. She's a hardcore technologist. You know, she was a coder. She came up with a lot of the innovations at Google. And she's also a woman, and technology is feminizing right now. Women do the majority of searches. They use social media more. They even buy devices more than men do.
Well, speaking of Herculean efforts getting underway, which is what Yahoo's up to, the Olympic Games kick off in London next week, and that city has been having a dickens of a time getting ready. Troops have been drafted to provide security, and then there's the traffic, miles-long roadblocks and long delays on the subways. The question we want to ask Joe Nocera is, will it be worth it in the long term? Does hosting the Olympic Games actually pay off for cities?
Financially, it almost never does, Jeff. London is spending $14 billion for these Olympics. It's hard to see how they're ever going to get a return on that capital. And if you look at the history, there are some successes. Los Angeles is a famous success. Beijing was a financial success the last go-around. But, you know, Montreal, you know, they were left with $2.7 billion in debt after the 76 Olympics. They finally paid it off in 2005. In Sydney, the long-term costs were $2.2 billion. Athens, it was budgeted at $1.6 billion. The final cost was $16 billion. It was a disaster.
You know, I want to say, I think it's funny that that happened in Greece, but there's another thing about the economics of the Olympics that we should think about, and that's the fact that it helps cities overcome problems, and it helps them get to their next stage of development. And I would actually point to Beijing on that front. Aside from being a financial success, it actually helped China grapple with a really important issue, which is the environment. A lot of economists actually think that environmental degradation in China is the biggest threat long-term to Chinese growth. And during the Olympics, there were a number of events that happened. At one point, a bunch of green algae bubbled up in one of the venues. Very high-profile events, got a lot of attention, embarrassed public officials in some cases, but it forced China to start to deal with its environmental problems, and that was a really important outcome from the Olympics.
Well, next week, while the run-up to the Olympics gets to frenzied state, we want to know what you're going to be looking at. So, Joe Nocera of The New York Times, what's on your radar?
Well, Jeff, earlier this week, the new agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, that was designed to help consumers, announced that it was going to regulate, for the first time ever, the credit reporting bureaus. Now, as you know, those are the fine folks that come up with your credit score. And they've never been regulated before, and they affect everyone's lives. And I think this has the potential to be a very big deal to watch how they regulate it. Will it be easier to challenge mistakes on your report? You know, will you be able to be told when there's changes in your report, when it goes up or down? The Bureau has the potential to make changes that could really affect our lives, and I think it's totally worth watching to see how they go about it.
Rana?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about the housing market. There's a bunch of recent data out that's very contradictory. The number of new housing starts, new homes being built, is actually up, which is a good sign, but sales are down. And I'm wondering if we're at a turning point about how Americans feel about the housing market. For the first time in history, it actually costs less now to pay a mortgage and own a home than it does to rent. Yet home ownership as a percentage is going down. So I wonder if this message that after the housing crisis, homes are no longer a part of the American dream or not as much of a part as they used to be, is sinking in, and what that's going to mean for the economy going forward.
Well, we'll be watching those stories and all the week's financial news at wnyc.org/business. You can also take this program with you as a podcast available for free on iTunes. I'm Jeff Greenfield. This is Money Talking from WNYC. Thanks for listening.